This is Christopher Leiden of Open Source. When you listen to Open Source on a podcast, you're part of a far-flung, truly global, wonderfully loyal audience, maybe the most expressive and interactive listenership in public radio. Would you take a moment, please, to do your part in a fundraiser now to keep this conversation alive? You'll find the details at radioopensource.org. We need you now as never before. Thanks. From Public Radio International, I'm Christopher Leiden. This is Open Source. Once upon a time, when Congress created Medicare for seniors in 1965, nobody thought to cover prescription drugs because in Lyndon Johnson's America, people didn't take drugs in a big way, and the drugs they took weren't expensive. That was before Lipitor for high cholesterol, before Celebrex for arthritis pain, before Zoloft for depression. It was before the phrase blockbuster drugs was invented for pills with $1 billion in annual sales. Before the giant drug companies, Big Pharma, rose to the top of the profit charts in American industry and settled there. Before seniors found themselves paying $1,500 a year for each of half a dozen prescription pills, $9,000 a year for maintenance. It was before all of us bought the dream, or was it a promise, that new drugs would cure pretty much all that ails us, from acne to Alzheimer's. Pharmacy Nation, in Mind and Body, is next on Open Source. I'm Christopher Leiden. This is Open Source, radio talk prompted by listeners who think, link, and write at radioopensource.org. Our guest, Marcia Angel, Dr. Marcia Angel, wrote an editorial once in the infinitely prestigious New England Journal of Medicine asking in her headline, "Is the medical profession for sale?" Came a letter with an answer. No, the current owner is quite satisfied to keep it. Marcia Angel and her letter writer were both referring to the drug industry, which not only advertises its new pills in the New England Journal, it provides doctors with $11 billion worth of free samples in a year. And nowadays, it buys slick ads in popular magazines and on television, urging us, the patients, to ask our doctors to prescribe those pills. We're asking Dr. Marcia Angel to open a general conversation that won't be over in 1 hour, on the promise and the perils in what we half jokingly call Pharmacy Nation. Post up your anxieties and the pills you take for them at our site, www.radioopensource.org. Marcia Angel, MD, was for 21 years an editor and then editor-in-chief of the New England Journal of Medicine. She's a senior lecturer in the Department of Social Medicine at the Harvard Medical School. Would you just remind us, for starters, Marcia Angel, how we came to Pharmacy Nation in our lifetimes, including the underlying sort of social premise that there's a pill for almost everything that's bugging you?
Yes, yes, you're quite right about that. At the beginning, the pharmaceutical industry consisted mainly of family-owned companies that were interested in finding important innovative drugs for serious diseases. And the assumption was that if they did their business, that profits would follow, that they'd be all right.
The model, it must be penicillin or something.
Yeah, or yeah. They were looking for drugs for unmet needs. And they figured if they did their job, if they did good research, profits would follow. This began to change around 1980, not coincidentally with the election of Ronald Reagan, and a very, very different attitude toward money and business. You just couldn't have too much money. And a very compliant Congress began to pass a series of laws that practically ensured windfall profits. So these companies that had been plenty profitable became stupendously profitable. And what they did with all their money was to use this and the influence that it bought to make the environment even better for them. So that led us to what you call Pharmacy Nation, which is a very good way of putting it.
I want to just keep reminding us and reminding you that many people are thrilled to be living in Pharmacy Nation and that there is huge promise. I mean, you read it in the paper every day. Doctors hope a pill or some sort of tweaking of the genome will cure Alzheimer's or bad skin or maybe even someday malaria, which kills millions of people all the time.
No, they're not working very hard on malaria.
Well, that's another whole matter. But no, I just want to say there is a supposed to be a huge silver lining behind all these profits, yes. which is to say cures for almost everything.
Yeah.
Now,
yeah.
you'll question that maybe or kick the premise, but it should be an awfully good time. You wrote in your book, which I read at the time and reread over this past weekend, The Truth About Drug Companies, you write that there was a year in this century when the top 10 pharmaceutical companies made more in profits than 490 other companies in the Fortune 500 combined.
That the profits, that was in 2002. That's correct.
It's almost impossible to get your head around.
Yes.
How can that be possible? That 10 companies all making drugs can have a bigger profit at the end of the year than all the rest of those huge profitable companies together.
Yes. Well, in that year, let me say in fairness, that a lot of companies had losses. And so when you added it all up, yes, the top 10 drug companies made more money than the other 490, but it was a tough time for business. Still, they have been year after year either the most profitable industry in the United States or close to it. Last year, they were number two. It might not surprise you to know that number one was petroleum and mining. But the pharmaceutical industry was number two. And to give you an idea, in the Fortune 500, the median profits for all of those biggest companies in the United States was 6.3% of sales. But the pharmaceutical industry, it was 20% of sales. 20% of sales last year. And Pfizer, the biggest drug company, had a profit margin of 37%. So that's right up there with Exxon. I mean, hugely profitable. And the important thing to remember is that this is year after year after year consistently. They want us to believe that they're a risky business, but a risky business has good years and bad years. For the pharmaceutical industry, every year is a good year.
I've forgotten why the oil companies have to be so rich, but the drug companies, we're told, have to be so rich because they're paying for research and development all the time to sustain this promise. What about it?
Well, the profit margin is after they've paid for R&D. But just look at that claim. When they say they have to cover their R&D, that implies that they spend most of their money on R&D and that afterwards they have only enough left over for modest profits. But the truth is very different. They spend over twice as much on marketing and administration as they do on R&D. And at the end of the year, they even have more left over in profits than they've spent on R&D. So R&D is the least of it. It would make more sense to argue that they have to charge the high prices in order to cover their gigantic marketing budgets and to maintain their obscene profits.
Marcia Angel, I'm interested more than anything in how this is changing the medical profession, but also our lives, our social expectations. What has it done to the profession that you entered?
Well, one of the things the pharmaceutical industry has done with its vast wealth is to co-opt every institution that could conceivably stand in its way of maximizing profits. And one of the major institutions is the medical profession. I think there was an article recently in the New York Times from data from Minnesota showing that the great majority of doctors have some financial connection to the pharmaceutical industry, to the industry whose drugs they are supposed to be impartially and critically evaluating. We're aware of the direct-to-consumer ads. We see them every time we watch a program.
Give me the chills. They're compromising the doctor-patient relationship.
Very much so. Very much so. What they spend on direct-to-consumer ads is small potatoes compared with what they spend advertising to doctors. Now, tens of billions of dollars. Mm. A lot of this they call education. The pharmaceutical industry sponsors most CME, that's continuing medical education for doctors, most meetings of professional societies. I like to say that everywhere two doctors are gathered together, so too is the pharmaceutical industry. They are everywhere, and they call it education, and doctors pretend to believe it's education. But you and I know, and doctors know, that you don't look to a company for impartial, objective information about a product itself. It just makes no sense. I mean, if you wanted to decide whether to buy a Toyota or a Honda, you wouldn't ask the Honda dealer. And yet the Honda dealer comes to a doctor's office and tells him or her what drugs to prescribe.
When do they cross the line of telling us what to ask the doctor for?
Well,
I mean, the doctor goes to medical school to figure out what to give us. I see these Ambien ads showing a guy, you know, ready for the meeting.
Yeah.
And of course, I mean, it looks like a clothing ad or something.
Yes.
But he's had his sleeping pill because he told the doctor to give it to him. But something's funny there.
Yeah. Well, something is indeed funny. We're the only country that permits that. Other advanced countries don't have direct-to-consumer ads for prescription drugs. But the companies know what they're doing. The doctor has to write the prescription. But the patient or the person watches it on television, goes into the doctor and says, I saw an ad for such and such. I think what he's supposed to say is Nexium right for me? And so he goes in and says, is Nexium right for me? And then you have to look at it from the doctor's point of view. The doctor, under the pressures of managed care, is seeing more and more patients more rapidly. The quickest way to get that patient out of your office is to write a prescription for the drug that he or she asked for, or more likely to reach into a cabinet for a free sample that the sales representative has left off.
That happens to all of us now.
Yes, and those free samples are never for generic drugs. They're for the newest, most expensive brand-name drugs. And so the doctor says, here, try this, let me know if it works. And both the doctor and the patient are then hooked on that drug, and when the free sample runs out, somebody else has to pay for it.
I was prescribed Vioxx with a free sample for a rotator cuff problem that, praise God, it resolved itself through exercise without surgery or drugs. But you wonder, how did that reflex get started? Just very quickly, though, also, impact. How do you measure the impact on medical schools and on hospitals?
Well, medical schools and hospitals have largely abdicated their responsibility to teach medical students and young doctors about prescribing prescription drugs. They've abdicated that responsibility to the industry that makes those drugs. So sales representatives from drug companies roam the halls of teaching hospitals, have free access to medical students and young doctors, buy them lunch, give them tickets to the Red Sox game, and essentially have taken over the job that the profession should be doing. The profession should educate its own.
We're going to take a short break. We're talking with Dr. Marcia Angel about the almost unimaginable rise in 25 years of the power of drug companies. When we come back, I'm going to push back with people's expectations, which are huge, dreamy, about what the genome century and pharmanation can do for us. This is Open Source. We'll be right back.
Hi, this is Dave Miller, Open Source Senior Producer. Blogs Day is approaching fast. It's this coming Thursday, and we're on the hunt for the best the web has to offer. Some themes have emerged. Clusters of posts about cancer, for example, and the first day of preschool, and life for U.S. troops outside the wire in Iraq. And we found a wonderful note from our old favorite Steve Almond on the deeply physical pleasure he gets from taking care of his new baby. So it's a great start, but we're hungry for more. Send us your favorite blog posts from this past Tuesday, June 5th, at radioopensource.org.
Open Source is produced in association with WGBH Radio in Boston. This is Open Source from PRI. I'm Christopher Leiden. This is Open Source. We're talking this hour with Dr. Marcia Angel about Pharmacy Nation, the big drug companies, and what they're doing to us. Listen.
You know how it goes. There's your love life. then there's your life. That's why for guys like me with ED, there's Cialis. Cialis is the only erectile dysfunction tablet clinically proven to both go to work fast, in as little as 30 minutes for some men, and work up to 36 hours. With Cialis, I can have the option of being ready fast, or have up to 36 hours to relax, knowing I can be ready when the moment is finally right.
Does your restless mind keep you from sleeping? Do you lie awake, exhausted, but still can't sleep? Maybe it's time to ask your doctor if Lunesta's right for you. For a limited time, you're invited to take the Lunesta 7-Night Challenge. Ask your doctor how to get 7 nights of Lunesta absolutely free. And see if it's the sleep aid you've been looking for.
Here's to men, to guys who want to spend more time having fun and less time in the men's room. And here's to Flomax. It may relieve male urinary symptoms due to BPH, also called an enlarged prostate, in 1 week. Only your doctor can tell if you have BPH, not prostate cancer. Ask your doctor. Flomax could make a difference in 1 week.
There's the push from the drug companies, Flomax and otherwise. I said I wanted to push back, Marcia Angel, with the general thought that consumers, brainwashed or not, think it's a golden age to be alive, because there's, if not today, tomorrow, there's going to be a cure for pretty much everything. And if not through a pill, through a tweaking of your DNA.
Yeah.
How do we deal with this?
Well, that's the public relations. If you...
No, but we'll also get to the science, too.
If you look at these three ads that you just played, Flomax, Cialis, what was the other one? Lunesta. These are all lifestyle.
It makes me sleepy just thinking about.
Stay awake, Chris. These are all lifestyle drugs. And that is something that is very important to notice. What the drug companies are doing now is targeting their drugs to the biggest possible market. I mean, that's economics 101. So they don't want to make drugs to treat really sick people. There are fewer sick people than there are well people. Their drugs are essentially targeting discontent or minor conditions, or lifestyle problems in essentially normal people. And if you look at the top-selling drugs, that's exactly what's going on. You also see that the drug companies are more and more inventing diseases to fit their drugs rather than finding drugs to treat diseases.
Give us an example of that.
A social anxiety disorder. Shyness. That's the industry's word for shyness. Now, who has not been shy? When I go to a cocktail party, I'm shy.
There are people out there who...
But what the industry is telling you is that shyness is a medical condition that requires treatment for the rest of your life. So they've got an infinite market. Or Cialis, the drugs for what they call erectile dysfunction now, an invented disease, essentially. Originally,
what do you call it? I mean, what's the other? How should
impotence
we think about it?
Impotence is what we used to call it.
Yes,
something that happened to every man from time to time. I mean, that's life. And originally, Viagra was pitched by Bob Dole to old guys who may have had diabetes or, you know, some cause for a problem, an ongoing problem. But you can see subtly it's gone to young guys, to the guys in the bathtub.
NFL heroes.
So now it's more of a party drug. It's I will accept nothing less than 100% performance at all times, or else I have a medical condition that needs lifelong treatment. So you can see what's going on here. The major top-selling drugs also target increasingly precursor conditions for diseases. High blood pressure in and of itself is a precursor to heart attacks, strokes, and things. And I don't want to throw out the baby with the bathwater. I mean, if you have high blood pressure, or high cholesterol, or high blood sugar, you do need treatment. But what you can see is that the industry and a lot of consultants, expert consultants who are on panels that issue guidelines, that they're expanding the criteria for high blood pressure or high cholesterol or even high blood sugar, so that pretty soon people are not supposed to have any blood sugar at all, any blood pressure at all, any cholesterol at all.
I want to come back, though, to the hopes that people have in these drugs. On our website, a writer named Huff said this. Let's take a quick minute, says Huff, to remember that these companies do occasionally create good things with their R&D and the money. If it weren't for a company called Novartis creating a drug called Gleevec, I probably wouldn't be alive.
Well, Gleevec was actually, the research was done at Oregon Health and Science University by an NIH-funded researcher. Okay. And it happened that Novartis had it on its shelf, owned the drug, but they were reluctant to do the research. And he insisted on doing it, and he did it with NIH funding. And almost overnight, it was found to be a really important drug for a certain kind of leukemia. Mm. That is one of the few truly innovative drugs to come to the market, but it was based on NIH-funded research. And that's an important change in this industry. Before 1980, all publicly funded research was in the public domain. You couldn't patent it if the NIH supported it. But in 1980, Congress passed a law that said that publicly funded researchers, mainly in universities and at the NIH itself, could patent their research and then give exclusive licenses to private drug companies. That meant that the drug companies no longer had to do their own research. They could live off of NIH-funded work. So since then, the drug companies have increasingly relied on universities, small biotech companies, for their innovative drugs. And what they have done, the research that they have done, has been based on turning out one Me Too drug after another.
But, Marcia, let's try to de-villainize it if it's possible. They're paying licensing fees. They do become the marketing agents, in effect, for government-funded research. You could surely argue that we pay twice for the NIH funding and then for the pill.
Yes.
But on the other hand, isn't there progress coming out of this?
I would be quite happy with that arrangement if they didn't claim more for themselves. Hmm. They justify their outrageous prices by presenting themselves as a source of innovation. But year after year, they're getting less and less innovative. If they said, we just manufacture drugs and we do some marketing. But let me say there that the marketing is almost entirely for Me Too drugs.
Me Too drug being a tweaked up
It's a small variation, not an aspirin.
It's a small variation
on a top-selling drug, which has a new patent, new monopoly rights, and is advertised as though it were an improvement. And let me give you a very good example. The number one selling drug in the world is Lipitor, Pfizer's Lipitor.
Right.
This is a statin drug to lower cholesterol. It's a Me Too drug. The first of this family came on the market in 1987, Merck's Mevacor, based on primarily university research and research done in Japan. Then after that, one after the other, statin drug came on the market. Lipitor is the fourth. They are almost never compared head-to-head in equivalent doses, but they are marketed as though they were improvements. For all we know, each one is worse than the one before. We have no way of knowing since they don't test them head-to-head. And that is the primary product of the pharmaceutical industry now, rhetoric and Me Too drugs. Some of these Me Too drug families are huge. Prozac was the first of a Me Too family, and now it has Lexapro and Celexa. There's no reason to think one is any better than the other. Prozac now is available as a generic. Nobody buys it anymore because it's not marketed.
That's fascinating. So they're always tweaking it just enough so they can patent it and charge you more.
That's right.
Go back to you touched on it, but Dora on our site asked you to speak about this technology transfer. It was all fostered by the Birch Bayh Bob Dole Act of 1980.
Mm-hmm. She's right.
Dora's question was how well is this kind of, it's not exactly laissez-faire capitalism, but a kind of, what would you call it, hybridized state capitalism from the point of view of the consumer?
Yeah. Well, the idea was to foster technology transfer, to get discoveries from the lab to the bedside as quickly as possible. And there was a perception back then that the U.S. was lagging behind Japan in doing this. Mm-hmm. And so the law, Bayh Dole, meant to introduce the profit motive by allowing publicly funded researchers to patent their work and then license it to drug companies. I am underwhelmed with the practical results of that. Yes, there were overnight many, many more patents. It gave birth to the biotech industry because what the medical schools, the researchers did often was to start their own startup company and then take the discovery from the university or from the teaching hospital and develop it somewhat in the biotech company and then sell it or license it to a drug company or even better, sell themselves to the drug company. And then everybody would enrich themselves at public expense, essentially. And it converted the medical schools and the universities to some extent into junior partners of the pharmaceutical industry.
Okay, but you just said, and it's fascinating, that it created the biotech industry in which, again, emotionally, not just economically, people have invested tremendous hope and comfort and assurance. As I said, we have ended the genome century. And most people, I think, expect, and some people celebrate, this manipulation of everything, whether it's,
yes,
you know, blue eyes, brown eyes, or their height or their social charm, but even, let's talk about cancer and cancer cures. Who would we expect to do it? And in America, wouldn't we assume that there are going to be big profits in here for somebody?
I think that we Americans now assume that. This was not true 25 years or so ago when the drug companies did their own cutting-edge research.
But we didn't think that cancer and leukemia would be treatable, maybe even curable in our lifetimes.
Oh, there was a lot of very good research
yes,
in those days. Let me go back a little to what happened with Bayh Dole. There were more patents, but I'm not at all convinced that those patents were particularly important. Nor am I convinced that they resulted in more technology transfer in the sense that patent laws were relaxed too, so that a lot of very basic discoveries like genes could be patented. And that created a thicket of licenses so that for any researcher to do research in an area, they suddenly had to pay royalties to many, many different companies at once in order to do the research. I think it's been a bottleneck to some extent. But the important thing, and the answer to your question about are we getting our money's worth, is that if you look at the top-selling drugs, they're almost all Me Too drugs whose progenitor came on the market in the 80s or even earlier. So in a sense, we're living on a big bang of a research that occurred 20-some years ago. There is very little new under the sun in this industry except promissory notes. I mean, we're waiting for Godot. We keep being told that, yes, the genome will, you know, will have tailored cancer treatment and so forth. Well, show me. And what I see year after year is more and more Me Too drugs. And the few cancer drugs that have come on the market will eke out maybe a few more months in metastatic disease that's not been responsive to anything else, and again, based largely on university research. So
wow,
that's
a serious caution. I mean, we'll come back to that. By the by, are you holding the drug companies to a higher standard than you would, say, ExxonMobil or Procter & Gamble? I mean, we don't worry about how much money they're spending on marketing, or that they're creating many, many more kinds of shampoo than we need.
I am in this sense, in two senses. One, people's lives and health can depend on prescription drugs. And behaving the way they do, there's an opportunity cost, too. When they are turning out one more cholesterol-lowering drug or one more blood pressure drug of the same class or one more erectile dysfunction drug, they are not doing research on malaria. They are not doing research on serious diseases. So, yes, that worries me, this is not breakfast cereal. People's lives depend on this.
Could we legislate directions to work on malaria? Or to get...
I think we could, in the sense that the other way I was going to say they're different is, while this industry talks the rhetoric of a free market, it's the last thing it wants, a free market. This is not a free market. This is an industry that, while it is free to make an erectile dysfunction drug instead of a malaria drug, and it's free to charge whatever the market will bear in the United States, not in other countries, it is utterly dependent on the government for its monopoly rights, long monopoly rights, for its research. I don't think that Exxon is dependent on the government for its research, and for all kinds of special breaks from Congress. One thing the drug industry has done with its money is to buy Congress. I mean, it has the largest lobby in Washington.
Well, I think that's important, and it's a big difference. ExxonMobil isn't life and death every day for us, but it's also not co-opting the great medical profession or Congress, as you say, or the medical schools,
mm-hmm.
or the hospitals.
Or the FDA. Which comes from its co-opting of Congress. The FDA is more of a lapdog than a watchdog now.
After the break, you must come back to this matter of keeping cancer research honest. You kind of shock me when you say this is they're playing with our minds with cancer cures. Do you mean that?
Oh, no. It's just, if you look at the clinical trials that underlay the newest cancer drugs, except for Gleevec, these are just eking out a little bit. Now, I'm not against that, because the treatment of childhood leukemia, which is now a huge success, involved many years ago the eking out week by week, month by month. But I am against charging $50,000 a year for it.
Hold it there. We're talking with Marcia Angel about Pharmacy Nation. When we come back, I want you to help us score as citizens a political campaign around health issues. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Dr. Marcia Angel, for many years, editor and then editor-in-chief of the New England Journal of Medicine, is our guest. We're talking about issues that she raised 3-4 years ago in a best-selling book called The Truth About the Drug Companies, The Power of Big Pharma. I want to stick with this just the again, this kind of wonderful citizen expectation that these things between genomic research and drug research we live in a different space. We live in a different emotional space with all of these things either being treatable or curable. What part of that is, as you say, waiting for Godot, who ain't coming?
Well, Godot may be coming, but not in the near future. I think it's partly wish, partly PR, to imply to Americans that all of these things are right around the corner. The cure for every ailment or discontent is right around the corner. When the facts are so much at odds with that, that they really have, you know, let me just give you a fact.
Sure.
If you look at the drugs that entered the market in the last 6 years, just in this decade, 2000 through 2005, when a drug is approved by the FDA, and it has to be approved by the FDA in order to be sold, the FDA classifies the drug in two ways. It classifies it according to whether it's likely to be an improvement over an existing drug.
Mm-hmm.
And it classifies it according to whether it's a new drug at all or just an old chemical in a slightly new form, new dosage form. And the shocking truth is that if you look at these 6 years and look at the FDA classifications, fully 80% of the 506 drugs that entered the market in those 6 years was classified as being unlikely to represent an improvement over existing drugs to treat the same condition. And 73% weren't even new drugs at all, just old drugs in different formulations or combinations. What they often do is combine two old drugs. There's a drug called Caduet, for example. You've probably seen that in ads. It shows two people, and then they merge, the image merges, and it says, finally, two ways to cure your hypertension in one pill. Hmm. Well, Caduet is just two old drugs. It's Lipitor and Norvasc, which are ending their patent lives. And so they're just put together, renamed, new patent, and there they are.
Hmm.
So that's what you see now. At the same time,
shampoo and conditioner in one bottle, right?
Exactly. But what you hear is this rhetoric, this pocket a queep rhetoric, you know, we're going to have these marvelous miracles. Just wait for it. Wait for it. It's coming. Well, maybe. But I'm from Missouri.
You know, I don't know if you saw it. Paul Krugman just slipped in a line the other day into a column about actually the reporting of the presidential debates. But he said, watch out for Hillary Clinton. She's got too much big pharma money in her campaign.
I'm sure she's not unique.
No, but he's monitoring it, and we know he likes
Edwards.
John Edwards' medical plan and Barack's number two. What does that tell you as a very seasoned observer of the politics here?
Yeah. Well, the industry has bought Congress. Pure and simple, it has bought Congress. It has the largest lobby in Washington, over 1,000 lobbyists.
Bought it against what and to what effect, other than their own profits?
Let me give you.
What are we as patients, as consumers, missing because Big Pharma owns Congress?
Well, one thing you're missing is a Medicare drug benefit that's affordable. You know, the industry essentially wrote the Medicare drug benefit, which passed at the end of 2003 and went into effect last year. And this benefit said that Medicare could not bargain directly with drug companies for lower prices, explicitly prohibited from doing that. Now, that was a bonanza to the pharmaceutical industry. And it was also unique because if you look at Medicare, it does regulate physicians' fees. It regulates hospital fees, but not prescription drugs. Also, if you look at the rest of government, if you look at the Veterans Affairs system, they get the best prices on drugs in the country because they bargain for very low prices. The big HMOs do. The big insurers do.
Anybody would.
Any
warehouse.
But here is the biggest purchaser of them all, Medicare. And Congress says you can't bargain for low prices. Well,
can you go to Canada?
No,
no,
you cannot go to Canada. And that's another present that Congress in 1987 gave to the pharmaceutical industry for just out of the blue said, can't buy your drugs anyplace else. Now, here's an industry that talks about a free market, but yet doesn't want any competition from Canada or Europe or Australia.
What's the caution, though, about a presidential candidate?
Oh, what the point here is that anybody important, the industry has given large amounts of money to. About 80% of their contributions go to Republicans, but 20% go to Democrats. And I suspect they're shifting even as we speak. That great sucking sound you hear is money going from Republicans to Democrats. And they're going to go to the presidential candidates for sure. And the tragedy is that our political life is so dependent on raising money that, in a sense, the candidates pretty much have to take the money wherever they can find it.
Is John Edwards immune?
I don't know.
And is his medical plan untainted?
I don't know. I don't know the answer to that, nor do I know, except for what Paul Krugman says, the extent to which Hillary Clinton has been funded by the industry. But I wouldn't be surprised if all of them don't get money from the pharmaceutical industry. I just don't know the answer to that.
Marcia Angel, what's changed since you wrote your book, and it was taken very, very seriously 3 or 4 years ago, and what do we do now? What do we do now as citizens and patients?
I think there's quite a bit we can do. Let me take the first question. Very little has changed, unfortunately, since my book was written. The Medicare drug benefit was a huge bonanza, and the industry is, if anything, more profitable than it was at the time my book came out. I think that the public is disillusioned. I think that is one change. The pharmaceutical industry is right down there with the cigarette industry in public esteem. I think that is progress. But as long as the industry has such a death grip on Congress and the medical profession, it's very hard for individuals to do anything. But the one thing Congress needs more than money is votes. And if the public says no, if you're going to take money from the pharmaceutical industry, if you're going to give gifts to the pharmaceutical industry like that Medicare drug benefit, then you're not going to get my vote. I think that's the best hope we have. Also, I think that the public has to get smarter about drugs. We have the belief that they're a lot better and safer than they are, because the industry publishes only the positive studies. And the negative studies remain buried largely, so that we come to believe that drugs are miracles when they may not be miracles and when they may be dangerous.
Somebody wrote on our site, it was acute, that Don't think of drugs as having side effects. They have multiple effects.
We never think of it that way. That's right. Exactly. And what we're seeing now, particularly among older Americans, is something called polypharmacy. We're taking 5, 6, 7, 8 drugs a day, every day. Nobody has studied drugs taken in that way. We don't know how they interact. We don't know how they act in old people usually, because most of the clinical trials are done in younger people, because then the drugs won't look as dangerous. So I'm very concerned that too many people are taking too many drugs.
One of our listeners who calls him or herself I Calypso in Taiwan wrote on our site 2 weeks ago, it's unfair to be beating up on the pharmaceutical companies as we are. We can't hold them to an unearthly standard. It's the FDA, says I Calypso, that's been exposed time and again as toothless, spineless, corrupt at worst. Why shouldn't the FDA be expected to perform a watchdog job here?
Well, it should. It should. But it, too, has been handed to the industry in the sense that Congress in 1992 passed something called the Prescription Drug User Fee Act. And this act provided for drug companies to pay the FDA a certain fee for each drug they reviewed. That fee is now big enough to account for over half of the budget of the Office at the FDA that approves new drugs. So the FDA now is on the payroll of the industry it's supposed to be regulating. Moreover, there was a quid pro quo. That money could be used only to speed up the approval of new drugs. It could not be used to monitor safety. It could not be used to monitor direct-to-consumer ads, which this agency is supposed to do. It could not be used to inspect manufacturing plants. It could only be used to speed up drugs. It has to be renewed every 5 years, and this is one of those years. So your listeners should write to their congresspeople and say, PDUFA is wrong. The user of the FDA is really the public, not the industry. The total fees amount to about $400 million a year. To the industry, this is chump change. I mean, they have bought the FDA very cheaply. This is about a day in Iraq, $400 million. I think Congress should buy back the FDA from the industry, cough up the $400 million.
Somebody's going to buy Congress back first.
Somebody's got to buy it. That's right.
Go back. You know, this reminds me of debates we've had in the past, really going back to all the soul-searching about Prozac and listening to Prozac and thinking hard about, do we want to go into, you know, churning up our bloodstream as a matter of course. And then we've argued it over Ritalin, too.
Right.
Ritalin with children. You scare me with this picture of the polypharmacy, seven, eight pills that we don't know how they interact, being routine in the pacification or the maintenance of older people. Is it too late to think about rethinking the taking of pills?
I think we should. I think we should. I'm appalled at the misuse of psychiatric drugs, particularly in Medicaid patients. These are people who have a hard enough time in life without staggering around with six or seven
Drugs and what conditions are you thinking about?
Well, there's often a diagnosis of bipolar disorder, depression, obsessive compulsive disorder,
What kind of pills do people get for?
They take anticonvulsants. They take a lot of off-label pills. They'll take Neurontin for a bipolar disorder, never been approved for that. And they add them all on. So they'll be taking an SSRI. They'll be taking one of the newer anti-schizophrenia drugs, Zyprexa or a drug like that. Plus they'll be taking Neurontin. Plus they'll be taking a sleeping pill. And so it's amazing to me that they can get up in the morning.
But if the social inhibition and the advertising inhibition has been removed, what in the world is going to stop people from taking pills that make them, in the short term, feel better?
Well, we don't quite know that it does make them feel better. You'd have to do the research to show that. I think that doctors believe a lot of the same PR that the patients get.
Of course.
And so there's a strong, particularly in psychiatric disorders, for which there is no objective criteria, it's possible for a huge placebo effect. Let me give you a very good example.
Okay.
Most of us think that the SSRIs were a big advance in the treatment of
serotonin.
Right. SSRIs is Paxil, Zoloft, Celexa. Lexapro, Prozac was the first of those. There was a study published a few years ago that really amazed me. Two researchers went to the FDA and used the Freedom of Information Act to obtain all 42 placebo-controlled trials that had been submitted to it to get approval for the six antidepressants that came on the market between 87 and 98. I think those were the correct years. And they were Prozac, Paxil, Zoloft, Suzone, and Celexa. Got all of the studies that the FDA had. Now, the drug companies, when they go for approval, are supposed to give the FDA all of the studies. But the FDA won't release them, won't make them public, without the company's consent.
Really?
So if two of the studies showed that a drug was better than a placebo, and that's the only standard, very low standard, better than a placebo, then it would get
better
approved.
Better than nothing.
Better than nothing. It would get approved and get on the market, never mind what the other six studies showed. And so these researchers wanted to see, Moore and Kirsch were their names, wanted to see all of the studies, not just the ones they chose to publish again and again, not just the ones that were used to get approval, but all of them. And what they found was startling. They found that looking at all six drugs, 42 clinical trials, placebo control, all six drugs, the effect was minimal.
Really?
An average of 2 points on the 62-point Hamilton depression score, not enough to be clinically significant.
Whoa.
Statistically significant, not clinically significant. And all six were the same. No drug was any better than the other. They were all equally ineffective, essentially. So what we have is a family of drugs. This is a family of Me Too drugs. All much the same. Marginal benefit. And yet we all believe that they're somehow effective with fewer side effects than the older antidepressants.
Your job as an advertising copywriter is to shine that sneaker, make that sound like happiness in a bottle. This is extraordinary and not a little depressing, Marcia Angel. But we're going to keep talking about it.
Which drug are you going to take for your depression?
I'm going to have maybe a martini. Does that count?
That sounds better to me.
Or a beer, anyway. Dr. Marcia Angel, thank you. We're going to come back to this conversation about Pharmacy Nation. You can keep talking about the drugs you take. You can help us work on the drugs we should take. You can pitch us a show idea of your own at radioopensource.org, where you can also download any show and subscribe to Open Source as a podcast. Open Source is produced in association with WGBH Radio in Boston. The program is made possible by the Schooner Foundation, whose contributors support the Landmine Survivors Network, offering health opportunities and rights to mine victims worldwide. Landminesurvivors.org. RadioOpenSource.org, our website, is hosted by Contegix, CONTEGIX.com. Our show is produced by David Miller, Catherine Bidwell, Chelsea Mers, Greta Pemberton, and Sam Gail Rosen, who all passed drug tests today. They had help from Garrett Zavidas. Robin Moore is our engineer. Mary McGrath is our homeopathic consultant. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.
PRI, Public Radio International.